person.
All right, let's take our seats. We're ready to get started again. All right. I would like to introduce at this time Dr. Lisa Olnos-Dekeu, who is an ophthalmologist with the University of Washington, and she'll be speaking to us about some current trends in the treatment of eye disease.
Thank you very much, Steve, and I'm really delighted to be here to speak about a subject that I'm very passionate about, which is vision restoration. A little bit about me. As Steve said, I'm an ophthalmologist, and specifically I'm a retina specialist. So I dedicate myself to treating, preventing diseases that affect the retina, surgically and medically. I'm a faculty member at the University of Washington, and I work up on First Hill at the Harborview Medical Center and the Eye Institute there. But I'm a recent transplant from Los Angeles, where I was... I have to be. I spent the last 5 years at the University of Southern California, and but I have equal love for UCLA, so no hard feelings there. And but I had the benefit while I was at USC of working with a remarkable technology that some of you may have heard about called the Argus II retinal prosthesis. And I was lucky enough to be able to be principal investigator of those clinical trials that culminated in the FDA approval of the device in 2013. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about my experience with that, as well as tying it into some of the research that's happening right now here in the Seattle area at the University of Washington. So my objectives today, I'm going to talk about, hopefully I can help answer the following questions. Number one, what is the current quality of vision restoration we can offer to our blind patients? What are the benefits of this, and what are the limitations? What future advances are close at hand, both in terms of new technologies and improvements of existing technologies? And how close are we to giving useful vision restoration to a large number of patients who are blind? And I'm going to highlight, as I mentioned, some of the University of Washington research. So retinitis pigmentosa. Many in the audience are familiar with this condition. It is a genetic cause of progressive visual impairment, and the first symptoms are often night blindness and loss of peripheral vision. And people may not notice that they're having these symptoms early on. And this occurs because the rod cells in the retina are damaged. Later on, the vision loss can progress and affect the central vision as well, and the color vision when the cone cells are damaged. And some patients, the minority, but some patients will lose the ability to see motion or even light. And I give this lecture usually to groups of people who are sighted and not sighted, and I'm going to describe some of the pictures that I normally show. I show a picture of a healthy retina with a pink optic nerve and healthy blood vessels and a sort of a salmon-colored retina, and then I show a picture of a retinitis pigmentosa patient, and in that you see the optic nerve looks pale. However, it is still functioning in most cases, which is very key to the therapies that I'll discuss. The blood vessels look thinner, and there are these sort of dark spots all around that we call bone spicules, and that those are hallmarks of the disease. And really, with this condition, there's an estimated 1 million worldwide that are affected, or 1 in 4,000. But the proportion with severe vision loss is considered a quote, orphan subset, or an orphan disease. And that's about 5% of all RP patients, so about 50,000 people worldwide who fall into that category. And this is really the main group of people that we focus on with some of these vision restoration technologies. Of course, there are a lot of diseases that are related to retinitis pigmentosa where photoreceptor cells are damaged or lost. But retinitis pigmentosa is sort of the classic hallmark disease that we look at. So how can we bring back vision to patients who have become blind as a result of this photoreceptor loss? Well, there's basically two main strategies. One is to stimulate the inner part of the retina and totally bypass the photoreceptors because they're damaged and in many cases missing. And that's what I'll talk mostly about today. But another way is cell transplantation. Many of you have heard of stem cells. And that is when we actually replace the photoreceptors that are gone. And my colleague at University of Washington, Dr. Jennifer Chow, has a lab that's fully devoted to that, to those efforts. I will tell you that we're a lot further away from that than some of the other technologies that I'll be discussing today, but it is definitely in the pipeline, and it is very exciting to be able to replace those cells. What I'll be talking about is how to bypass those cells and just hook into the inner retina, which in retinitis pigmentosa and related condition is actually still functioning just fine in many cases. So we can do that with electrodes, which is where the retinal prosthesis comes in, or we can actually do it with light, in which we take these compounds, these chemical compounds called photoswitches, and place them on the retina, and that allows the retina that's there, the retinal cells, to turn into photoreceptors and act like photoreceptors. It's pretty amazing. That's called a chemical photoswitch. And then the other way you can do it with light is through optogenetics. So you can actually use a gene therapy and change the parts of the retina that aren't photoreceptors into functioning like photoreceptors. And we're also doing that. And finally, you can use ultrasound to stimulate the inner retina. So we have a lot of pathways that we can focus on. The stem cell replacement, the chip prosthetics, the photoreceptive molecules, or the photoswitches, and then the chemicals. So I'm going to be talking right now about chip prosthetics, or so-called bionic eyes. And I guess the technical name for this is a retinal prosthesis. What is a retinal prosthesis? Well, it delivers electrical stimulation to the retina to create artificial vision. And there are two retinal prostheses that are currently available to the public that is outside of clinical trials. And one of them is called the Argus II, and that's the one that I've been working on at USC. It's manufactured by a company called Second Sight Medical Products, and it got its FDA approval through a humanitarian device exemption for an orphan subset in 2013. And the other one is called the Alpha IMS Retina Implant AG, and it is only available in Europe, where it got its CE mark. The CE mark is the equivalent of FDA approval in Europe in 2013. And I'll be talking more about the Argus because that's the device I'm really familiar with. So there are several major design strategies for these retinal prostheses. You can put them on top of the retina, underneath the retina, or under the wall of the eye. You can use electricity to power them, or photoelectricity to dilate, to power them. And then you can have different numbers of electrodes or photodiodes, and you can put them in different configurations. And there are a number of these retinal prostheses in clinical trials. There are at least 8 out there that are being tested, but I will talk now about the Argus II. The Argus II, as I mentioned, is designed to create artificial vision in patients who have lost their photoreceptors. And as of this year, as of late this year, there have been over 180 devices implanted worldwide. And why is it called the Argus? Some of you may be wondering. Actually, in Greek mythology, Argus Panoptes was a 100-eyed giant. And he was the watchman for the goddess Hera, which was really handy because whenever he needed to take a nap and get some shut-eye, he always had some spare eyes that could be open and watching. So that was the inspiration for the name Argus. How does the Argus work? Well, basically there's a pair of glasses, and on the bridge of the glasses is a little camera, and that records real-time image right in front of the person who's wearing it. And those images are then processed by a little computer called a video processing unit that sits either hooked to your belt or on a strap around your shoulder, around your neck. It's about the size of a deck of cards. And then that signal, that simplified signal that's processed by the VPU, is sent wirelessly to a coil that's implanted on the eye wall. And this coil that's implanted on the eye wall is connected to this electrode array, which sits right on top of the retina. And that's where I come in. So this coil and this electrode array has to be implanted onto the eye. And then what happens is the electrodes stimulate that retina that's there, and the optic nerve will transmit that signal back to the brain and create a sort of artificial vision. So as I mentioned, the Argus has two components. There's the external component, which is the video and the video processing unit. And you can take it off and put it away, and no one would ever know you have the Argus. And then there's the part that's implanted onto the eye, around the eye, and inside the eye that kind of stays there permanently and is not active at all unless you put on the camera and power up the computer, so to speak. And there are 60 little electrodes on this electrode array. It looks kind of like a little postage stamp that sits on top of your retina. And it's connected through a flat cable, and the cable actually exits the eye and connects to that coil that sits on top of the eye. So what can an Argus patient expect? Well, surgery takes around 4 hours, sometimes a little less, under general anesthesia, but it is an outpatient procedure. That is to say, you can go home after surgery, recover, come back the next day for an eye check. And after usually about 1 week of recovery, device programming can begin. And device programming is very important because you've got to program all those little electrodes to the right energy level. And artificial vision that the patients get is different from quote-unquote normal vision that all these patients used to have before their retinitis pigmentosa progressed. So the patients will report that they see spots or kind of lines or little comet shapes of light that they kind of learn to interpret as shapes and objects. And it's really very similar to learning a different or new language. It takes effort, takes some persistence and hard work, but it can be very successful if you're motivated. Recently, our group published a 5-year safety and performance results of the clinical trial, which was started back in 2007 when we started implanting the Argus II as part of a 30-patient clinical trial that was multi-center across the U.S. And we had some, how do we test this device? Well, we used some tests like localizing a square. So we show a dark square on a white computer background or a white square on a dark computer background, and the patient would need to point with their finger to where the square is. Direction of motion, so it would be a stripe, a line moving. And could the patient tell which direction the line was moving? And trying to get a vision or a vision measurement with what we call gratings. And then we looked at it with functional tasks. That is to say, finding a door, finding a doorway, getting to the door, or following a line, which is very practical, you know, walking down a hallway or walking down your street. And we found that there is significant improvement with the device, and that is sustained up to at least 5 years out, which is pretty incredible. These devices can stay functioning and working really well for that long. And I think right now the longest implant duration for the Argus II is almost 9 years right now. So what's the vision like with Argus II? As I mentioned, patients will tell you that they see spots and lines of light. The vision field is constricted, which patients with retinitis pigmentosa are not strangers to having a constricted visual field, but it's about 20 degrees. So it's really, in order to see a broad ray in front of you, the patient will need to move their entire head to use the video camera to scan. And if you imagine the eye chart with the big E, most people can kind of visualize that big E, that we call 2400. So then if you can't see that, the next step we take at the eye doctor's office is usually to put up some fingers and say about a foot or two away, can you see the fingers? Well, the vision that these patients measure with the Argus is about 26,000. So it's not as good as the big E on the eye chart. However, there are some zoom and magnification programs that can get it as good as 2200 with scanning capabilities. Also, so what can an Argus patient do with this level of vision? It sounds like, well, it may not be that, you know, that great a vision. But actually, patients have told me that they've been able to locate doors, locate windows, sort laundry into light and dark, stay within a crosswalk, avoid obstacles, and really feel more socially connected when in a room of people, being able to turn towards some people when talking and chatting. One of my patients was implanted in June, and she got to see the fireworks on the 4th of July. Probably a really neat view, different from what me as a sighted person would see. I'm sure it was really cool and different seeing those fireworks in an electronic way. She's a hockey fan. That particular patient can see hockey players in dark outfits on the white ice. Various different things that our patients have been able to do with this device. For people who are really very visually impaired due to retinitis pigmentosa, it can be very helpful. Well, what are the limitations? With the ARGUS, the patients cannot expect to recognize faces, which is tough because a lot of my patients will come saying, well, I've never seen my son's face, or I'd love to see my grandkids. And that would be possible with sort of the outline of the person, but not the facial features. ARGUS patients can expect to read standard print at a normal pace, although they can make out letters with scanning. And large print letters they've been able to trace with their fingers. ARGUS patients can't expect to drive a car or see colors that correspond to the objects in the traditional sense. Most of the patients have reported sort of black and white vision. However, some patients see different colors. We haven't been able to figure out what, you know, how this exactly corresponds to the electrical stimulation. So, but it's certainly not that you see an object the color that everyone else might see it. And sometimes we're really actually surprised by what ARGUS patients can do. I usually show a video of one of my patients who has no light perception vision. So she cannot see light due to retinitis pigmentosa. And in this video, she's standing there with her wearing her glasses and her video processing unit. And she has a bowling ball in her hand. She's at a bowling alley and she just rolls it right down the center and knocks down all the pins. It is pretty inspiring. And you might ask, how did she do that? Could she see the pins? Well, no, she could actually see the gutters, which were dark, contrasting with the wood of the lane. And she was able to put it right down in the middle. And so it's actually pretty impressive what you can do if you put your mind to it with the right technology. So that's the ARGUS. The ARGUS is not for everyone, because you really have to have a functioning optic nerve in order to benefit from it. So patients who are blind due to damage from the optic nerve or who have advanced glaucoma, it actually won't work because it requires that intact hookup from what's left of the retina to through the optic nerve to the brain. You have to have a certain shape of your eye, what we call the standard shape of the eye. So patients with eyes that are very long or very short or have what we call a staphyloma or kind of a bulge in the eye, we can't actually fit the device in there properly. So there are some limitations there. So now this is a good segue for me to talk about chemical reanimation, which is some of the research that I am starting to work on now that I'm here at the University of Washington. And basically, we have these compounds, and we call them photo-switchable affinity ligands, or photo-switches. And basically, light, when it hits these little chemical molecules, changes the configuration, the chemical configuration of them, so that neurons fire, and that converts, as I mentioned, these retinal cells that are not photoreceptors into acting just like photoreceptors. So it's pretty amazing. We went through a first-generation compound, a second generation compound, and now we're on a third generation compound, and we're kind of testing these. The first generation compound, we needed to only use blue light to stimulate it, and we needed a second light to turn it off. The second generation compound was great with white light and normal light, but it didn't mix very well inside fluid inside the eye. Now our third generation compound is pretty great. It is very soluble, and it has a staining problem where it's staining a lot of the different tissues. So we're actually working on surgical techniques about how to deliver it properly, so that we can get this molecule to coat the retina and convert it into acting like photoreceptors. So that's one of the things that's going on right now in the lab that I've joined just recently. We're really hoping to bring this to clinical trials in patients soon. That's kind of our goal. I mean, that's my 5-year plan. And back to retinitis pigmentosa. It affects many people very profoundly. There's another condition that is much more common that this is also applicable for, and that is age-related macular degeneration. And that's a condition I know many of you have heard about. It mainly affects adults over the age of 55, and it can be very silent because you can have dry macular degeneration in a mild form for a long time and not even know about it unless someone were to dilate your eyes and look at it. And that can convert onto the wet form with bleeding and scarring, or advanced dry form where you get something called geographic atrophy and the photoreceptors are lost. And so you get a what we call a central scotoma, or a blind spot right in the center, which is, you know, where you can't see faces, you can't read the clock or do fine reading, painting, needlework. It becomes very difficult. Of course, you retain your peripheral vision, unlike in retinitis pigmentosa, but these strategies are applicable to that condition as well because it's photoreceptor loss. So in conclusion, with vision restoration, artificial vision, like the Argus, is very useful for the right patients. And it really has helped give patients increased independence and improved quality of life. And there are a lot of people who can benefit. However, there is room for improvement. There are a lot of people who may not qualify or who may not have vision that's, quote, bad enough to benefit from these retinal prostheses. And that's why we're kind of working on new strategies for vision restoration that can benefit larger groups of people. There's also research on the retinal prostheses improving them and actually directly stimulating the brain as well and bypassing that optic nerve. So I want to thank my research collaborators, Dr. Humayun, one of my mentors at University of Southern California, the brilliant scientists at Second Sight, my colleagues here at the University of Washington, my research supporters, and most of all, my clinical trial patients. These are individuals who have selflessly sacrificed for the good of really all society in participating in clinical trials to improve vision restoration. And I'm just honored to have had the opportunity to work with all of them. And thank you for your attention today.
All right, we have time for a couple of questions. If someone, do we have a mic runner? Does anyone have a question?
Let's hear it. Yeah.
Let's get a mic so that ACB Radio can hear it as well.
Where are you?
We're
live streaming. Across the nation.
Thank you.
Yes. Do you have to take anti-rejection drugs when you get these prosthetics?
No.
No?
No, awesome. It's wonderful. It is not. It's very well tolerated. The electronics are coated in silicone, which is very well tolerated. So no need for immunosuppression.
And what are you seeing as some of the side effects of these prosthetics?
So the main, we call them adverse events or complications that you could get are mainly as a result of the surgery. So in order to implant the array, the electrode array into the eye, you have to make about a 5-millimeter cut on the white part of the eye. That's called the sclera. 5 millimeters may seem really small, but in the world of an eyeball, which itself is really small, it's kind of big. So it's very important to meticulously sew that up, and that cable you pokes through there and has to keep poking through, and you have to cover it up really well with the conjunctiva, which is kind of the skin of the eye. And if it erodes through or leaks out, you can get an infection there. So that's kind of the main issue.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Hi, this is Haley Eggers, and I'm so excited that Dr. Almos is here because I actually went down to USC last April, I think it was, and to see if I qualified for the Argus II. So when I saw her on the agenda for today, I kind of tracked her down and was super excited. So I did not qualify, but I'm hopeful with this new research that's coming out now with the photoreceptor information. But if anyone has questions about, like, what the testing, because I know Dr. Almos has to leave, but, like, what I might have had to do for the testing to see if I qualified, by no means am I a doctor, but I'll be here all weekend, so.
Oh, thanks so much, Haley. And also, Steve has my email address in case there are any questions that come up.
One last question.
You were talking about the how the prosthetic fits on the eye. A lot of people that have had vision loss have eyes that have shrunk. So what happens there? I mean, it's a lot of times you may have an eye that's not working, so the eye has shrunk down.
Right.
Does that cause a problem?
Yeah, so I think the medical term for what you're describing is called ptysis, spelled P-H-T-H-I-S-I-S. It's one of those spelling bee words, ptysis. So that's when the body kind of rejects an eye that is not working, and it can shrink down and look different. In many of those cases, in fact, most, the optic nerve is not functioning. Therefore, unfortunately, the Argus will not actually work. So you must have a functioning optic nerve and an eye that is kind of standard size in order to have surgery inside, remove the vitreous, and put the electrode array mm-hmm. on the retina. That's another limitation of the device.
So how do you – I'm sorry. I'm just curious. The optic nerve, when it's not working, that means you see nothing. Is that right?
No, not necessarily, actually. Some people can have partial optic nerve damage and see even 20/20 with a very constricted visual field or very low color vision, very low contrast sensitivity. So there's an array of optic nerve damage. But typically with retinitis pigmentosa, isolated with no other conditions, we see, even though some people can have very little ability to see light, their optic nerve, if you test it, it's actually intact.
That's all great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's really enlightening and exciting to see all the work that these researchers are doing on our behalf. And I think Lisa just touched on a couple of things that are occurring within the field of research and vision loss. So we thank all of them. Don't ask me to respell it. Yeah, let's do one door prize, and then I'll introduce our panel.
From who? All right, we're into money right now. Yay. We have a $25 MasterCard from Skagit County, and here's the pile of names. Who's going to get $25? Oh, dear. Asamusada Saada.
No.
Pat Copeland, she's in exhibits, is that right?
No.
She's not. All right. Mary Sutherland. Snooze you lose. That's right. We're going to get there. Mark Adrian. Mark, you're not here, huh? All right. Shannon Curry. I think everybody left.
I can't believe it's this difficult to give money on.
Yeah, I know. My gosh. Byron Kesmarski.
He's outside in the hallway.
Well, too bad. Some of the names I'm not sure about pronunciation, but Philip Bley, B-L-E-Y-H-L. He just left. Oh, poor guy. That's too bad. Darn. All right. Janice Squires. Hang on. This is hilarious. Holly Kazmarski. We got the Kazmarskis in here. This is hilarious.
No, we don't.
Okay. Yeah. Imelda Ortiz. You didn't know it takes long, did you, Steve? Terry Atwater.
I'm here.
Yay, Terry! Woohoo! All right. Yeah. Yes.
All right, success. Trophy. I would like to introduce our next panelist, and then I will introduce Mary Beth Harrison, who is the director of the Blind Veterans Rehabilitation Center, and then I will let her introduce her co-panelists. So, Mary Beth. Yep.
So thank you, Steve, for inviting us, and we have the unenviable position of being the speakers before lunch. So we will try to condense our information as much as we can and still hopefully be informative. I represent the VA Blind Rehabilitation Program at, officially it's VA Puget Sound, but it's the Seattle and Tacoma or American Lake Blind Rehab Center. And with me today are two veterans who've been through our program who represent the Washington Regional Group of the Blinded Veterans Association. And that would be Deidre Maxwell, who's here with her dog Mark, and Mike Pistachio on my far left. And then to my right is one of our staff members who teaches orientation and mobility as well as technology, and that's Matthew Collins. So I want to start by giving you a little bit of an overview of what VA does for blind and visually impaired veterans. Our program at the American Lake Blind Rehab Center is the fourth blind rehab center to open nationwide. We opened in 1971. VA has been in the blind rehab business since 1948. Now there's 13 what we call inpatient programs, since we're part of a medical model, where it's a residential program for average of about 6 weeks. There's 13 of them nationwide. But what's unique about the Veterans Affairs system of care is that we're the only system of care that integrates blind and low vision rehabilitation throughout the whole continuum of care. So every VA hospital has at least a part-time low vision optometrist, and that's what we would call an intermediate low vision clinic, working its way up through what they call advanced low vision clinics, where they also have blind rehabilitation specialists on staff. They could be low vision therapists, vision rehabilitation therapists, and orientation and mobility therapists or specialists, up through what we call the visor program, which is a 7 to 10 day program that's intensive, where veterans come and stay in VA terminology. It's called a hoptel, but basically it's not quite a hospital because they don't have nursing care, but it's a residential program for 7 to 10 days where they can get more intensive training. And then our program, which is a comprehensive full meal deal of blind rehabilitation from soup to nuts. Matthew is going to talk more about the specifics of that. Since all the patients who go through the program, and excuse me, I started out saying clients when I got into the field, but now that I've been in the VA for 22 years, I've started saying patients because it's a hospital and we're part of a medical model. But most of our veterans are folks who have lost their vision due to age-related and disease processes. So we have macular degeneration and glaucoma and diabetic retinopathy as our top three causes of vision loss, but we do see a variety of other conditions as well. Retinitis pigmentosa, your RP, that we were just hearing such interesting information about possibilities for those folks. We have a few patients who have RP, but most of the time, since that's starting to affect their vision before they would be at of age to be in the service, we don't have as many folks who have RP in our program. So blind rehabilitation nationwide and vision rehabilitation starts with what we call visual impairment service team coordinators, or VIST coordinators. And there's 166 VIST coordinators nationwide serving over 200 facilities. Some of those VIST coordinators are part-time at more than one facility. That includes VA hospitals and VA community outpatient clinics. Working closely with those folks are blind rehabilitation outpatient specialists who go into the home, and they have up to they have 93 of them currently in our system. So if you're talking the whole country, and that even includes Puerto Rico, one of our blind centers is in Puerto Rico, we're not talking a lot of coverage there. But we are fortunate to have two of them in the Puget Sound region, one based in Seattle, one based in Tacoma, as well as one based in Spokane, and one based in the Portland, Oregon, Vancouver, Washington area. So we have four blind rehabilitation outpatient specialists who sometimes travel 150, 200 miles to see veterans. And then the outpatient programs where folks come into the facility for training, that's hooked up between the low vision optometry, where you get a thorough low vision exam, and with the VIST coordinator making the referrals. Most of the veterans we see at the inpatient program are average age of 70 and up, but we do see a wide range of folks who lost their vision young through the war, or folks who are up to 90, 95 years old, who may be World War II vets. Primarily right now we're seeing mostly folks from the Vietnam era and some from the Korean War era. But one misunderstanding that a lot of folks have about VA is that your services need to be provided only if your low vision or blindness is caused by a war-related, combat-related injury, and that is not the case. Anyone who served their country who has low vision or legal blindness is eligible for VA services. A lot of folks who've been employed and had medical insurance through their companies didn't use VA services and didn't even think they were eligible, but they are eligible, especially for those services that VA can provide that aren't available elsewhere. The blind veterans and low vision veterans nationwide who are currently being served by the visual impairment services teams is almost 50,000, and approximately 10,000 of them were served by the outpatient specialists last year, and over 2,000 in the inpatient blind rehabilitation centers. Our outpatient low vision clinics, including the outpatient optometry for low vision, served approximately 18,000 veterans with vision loss last year. One thing that's, we're very fortunate in the VA, and veterans are very fortunate, as unfortunately the state and the private services can't do as much, is our ability to provide what the VA calls prosthetics. It's basically your equipment, your technology, anything from a white cane up to a full computer system with software access and the printer to go with it. So that's something that the VA can do. For visual impairment, the estimate of veterans in the country who have visual impairment of 20/70 or worse vision is over 1 million. And I just mentioned that we served 50,000 in the visual impairment service teams. So as you can tell, there's a lot of veterans that aren't being reached. And we did bring just some basic trifold brochures that I left on the same table that has the WCB information near the registration desk, or a left turn if you're going out of this room. So if you are a veteran, or if you know someone who's a veteran with vision loss, I'd really appreciate if you'd spread the word. Since we have three other people to speak, I'm going to cut short the rest of the information I have, but if there's any time at the end, and I'm also going to be staying around for the lunch, and please feel free to come up and ask questions. I'm going to turn it over now to Matt Collins to talk about how our program works and the services we provide.
Thank you, Mary Beth. Good morning, everybody. Everybody looking a little hungry right now, so I'll try to keep this pretty brief here. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about the services that we offer at the Blind Center at American Lake. Just so everybody knows, like Mary Beth said, it's a six-week program. It's definitely a luxury to have that amount of time with anybody. But one of the things that I really love about working for the VA is the fact that we can be so focused on the patient needs. And so in our case, it's not a one-size-fits-all program. We can see what people are doing well, what people might need some assistance with, and then focus on those items to really work on for their goals. And so the nice thing too is it's a very, very much a team atmosphere. So we try to include the veterans with all the decisions regarding their program, whether it be if they are going to work on street crossings or if they're going to get a new piece of technology, or do a project in our shop class. So I'll just talk briefly about each of our areas that we offer. The first being manual skills. It is what we would maybe call a shop class. And the main focus of that class is to work with the hands. So a lot of times people come in still trying to use their vision for all sorts of tasks that might actually be better to use their hands with. And so in manual skills, they focus on dexterity, hand strength, really working on, you know, being aware of spatial things and whatnot so that, you know, people when they go home can do projects around the house, such as home repair. We do have part of the program, electrical repair, plumbing repair, and a wood shop. So there's quite a variety of things that we offer through manual skills. And one cool thing that we just started was a small engine building. So quite a variety of items that people can do through our program. The next class that we offer is living skills, and that focuses on tasks of daily living. That could be anything between check writing to reading labels to doing laundry or cooking meals, money handling, all those things that might help somebody get through the day a little bit easier, more easily. And then after that, we offer computers. And in computers, we have quite a range of things that we offer. We do anything from the iPhone and iPad training to Guide, if you're familiar with Guide, to Zoom Text, to JAWS. We do both Mac and PC platforms, so we have quite a bit of option for offering what works best for the veterans that come in. One thing that's probably the most popular is the iPhone program. There's a lot of devices out there that, you know, are somewhat being replaced because of the iPhone. So people get excited by the prospect of using GPS and being able to send email and talking with Siri and using all of those, you know, nifty little tricks to interact with their family and neighbors and whatnot. So that's computers. And in orientation mobility, this is a passion of mine. It's, of course, travel-related skills. So anything that we can do to help people maintain independence or gain independence and also be safe while traveling in the community. We do things such as long cane training. Sometimes we incorporate support canes or walkers for people that have stamina issues or need additional support. We also even work with power scooters and power chairs. And we also offer night lessons. So if somebody has trouble with traveling at night, we offer that. We come in at night and walk around the neighborhoods and analyze how we can do things better. So that's something that we offer, as well as GPS. So one of our speakers, Deirdre, and I worked on GPS, and we did it through the iPhone. And it's really cool to see the technology coming along to really help people get to where they need to go safely and efficiently. Last but not least, for the core skills that we work on, we have visual skills. I don't know if Mary Beth mentioned it, but about 90% of the vets that we see have some level of vision. So a lot of what we do is focus on, you know, how to improve their use of the vision that they still have. And so a lot of that comes through the use of a CCTV, a different type of reading device, handheld magnifiers, anything else that will help somebody access print. So that might be newspapers, books, labels, or other printed materials. So with that, you know, we try to help people, you know, be able to read their mail and be more independent with those types of tasks. A couple other quick things that we offer on the in the program as well is nursing services. We do have nursing staff available 24 hours a day. One of the great things that they do is education with the veterans regarding different things such as diabetes or med management and things like that, so that they have a better awareness of how to, again, be more independent and handle those things on their own. So that's a real exciting thing for us. And then we also even have dietary services. You know, they can assist with helping people pick appropriate meals. We do see a lot of diabetes-related vision issues at our center, so that's a very big one for us. We even do psych evaluations for people that might have cognitive issues, memory issues, things like that. And that helps us gain a better understanding of the veteran so that we can provide services in the way that works best for them. And last but not least, we do offer recreation as well. We really strive to have people use their new skills in the community. So we've done things like go to the LeMay Car Museum or Music in the Park, farmers markets, things like that. So we really try to have a well-rounded program so that when people come in, they can understand how the skills that they're working on can really benefit them through a variety of environments. So that's my part of the speak. Here.
Tell them who we serve, what region, since I've
Oh, that's a good point. So the VA itself has quite a few regions, not to get into it too much, but there's 22 regions, I believe, 21, 22 regions. And we primarily serve the Pacific Northwest, so that includes Washington, Oregon, Idaho. We do get people from Montana and Alaska quite a bit as well. Technically, if people are interested and they're in different parts of the country, if they really want to come to Washington and see our sunny days, we do have that available to them as well. So we serve this region, but yes, we can see people from all over the country at times. So. And here's somebody to speak about their experience with our program, and that her name is Deirdre Maxwell and her dog, Mark. Mark won't be speaking, though, I'm sorry. Thank you. Maybe so.
I'll be the shortest of the speakers. I'm obviously a veteran. I lost my vision because you're supposed to land on your feet in it when you jump out of an airplane, not your head. Remember that. Cut short my Army career, and that was 30 years ago. At the time, the VA and women were not a good fit, and it took me all this time to get here, and it was life-changing. You know, I don't have to call my son to read every bill for me now. I relearned how to cook, and this was just a fabulous, fabulous thing. And I'll let...
Did you want to talk about getting your ORCAM?
Oh, and the big one was I got an ORCAM, which is just an amazing machine. I'm not wearing it right now. But I can read signs. I can read what bus is coming, stop signs, menu boards at McDonald's. It's just amazing.
Thank you, Deirdre. Like Mary Beth said, my name is Mike Pistachio. I work at the Blind Center. I'm also a graduate of the Blind Center. I graduated in March 2010, and because of my vision, I wasn't able to work anymore. And about 3 months after I graduated, the former director of the Blind Center gave me a call and said, Mike, I know you're not working. Do you want a job? So I cupped my hand over the cell phone. I said, let me ask my wife. So I cupped my hand over the cell phone, took it down, and says, yes. He said his secretary just retired, so that's what I do there. But I'm not here to talk about the Blind Center. I'm here to talk about the Blinded Veterans Association. The local group, the Washington Regional Group, is They meet once a month, usually once a month. Sometimes we skip a month, like during the summer or when there's a bunch of holidays. We meet at the La Quinta Inn down by the Tacoma Dome in Tacoma. And the meeting there is a short meeting, and then we have a lunch. So that's what we do locally. Michelle Tungle is our president. I'm the vice president. Alice Stevenson, you might know her, is the outgoing. She's retiring as secretary. I think we're trying to talk Deirdre into taking over her job. So maybe, did you know about that? Okay. Maybe I let the cat out of the bag. Okay. The mission of the BVA is to promote the welfare of blinded veterans so that notwithstanding their disabilities, they may take their rightful place in the community and work with their fellow citizens toward the creation of a peaceful world. So basically, it's promoted, blinded veterans are promoted access back into society, which they might, after they became visually impaired, some totally blind, some from diabetic retinopathy like myself. Most of them can't drive anymore, which is a huge thing for a guy having to give up his driver's license. So a little bit of BVA history. In March 28th, 1945, 100 veterans, blinded veterans, met in their rehab center. It was a hospital, and they decided to go ahead and form a group, form an organization. It wasn't really an organization. It was just a bunch of guys meeting at the time. And they were recently blinded. 13 years later, the BVA was chartered by Congress to speak and write on behalf of blinded veterans in national legislative affairs. So we have, we're chartered by Congress. That's a big thing for any civic organization. That's at the national level. Our headquarters is in Alexandria, Virginia. There is the organization of the BVA. There's 6 national districts. There is membership fees, just to let you know. Annual membership fees go from $100 to $50, depending on your age. And that's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
So I want to mention one or two other things, and then we might have time for one or two questions before everyone runs to lunch. But I did want to mention that, as Mike said, the Blinded Veterans Association is chartered by Congress, and one really, really important part of our partnership, the blind rehab services of VA with BVA, is because BVA is advocating for veteran services, and BRS, Blind Rehab Services, provides those services. They're the ones who are allowed to go to Congress and lobby. They have the ability to testify to the congressional legislative affairs committees. So things like, well, they have these new computers out there, and I think we'll provide them to veterans who are working age, is how it worked when I started in the VA 22 years ago. But there's a lot of other reasons to use a computer besides getting a job. So one of the things the BVA did 20 years ago was to advocate so that any blind veteran could be trained on and receive a computer that allows them to access the same thing their sighted peers were. So that's one of the things the blinded veterans do, is they get the ear of Congress to move things forward. And although some of it's very specific to blind veterans, other parts of it are working with National Blindness Associations to advocate for disability rights and vision impairment services nationwide. So that's the one other thing I wanted to mention, is that the Veterans Affairs hospitals provide so much training for blind rehabilitation specialists, eye doctors, medical doctors, physical therapists, dietitians, occupational therapists. The VA is the largest trainer of any sort of medical and rehab professionals in the country. So that's another thing that we're proud of being a part of. And we have interns with us in orientation mobility. We have one right now who's with us, and we have one who was with us over the summer who we ended up hiring. So that's another accomplishment of VA that we're proud of, and I just kind of wanted to blow our horn a little bit, because you all, like myself, have heard plenty of negative about the VA. We are far from perfect as a big organization, but we strive to do the best we can for veterans who have vision loss, and those of us who work in the field are pretty passionate about it. You don't go into blind rehab for the money. So anyways, do we have time for... We have no time for questions, so I'll turn it back over to Steve so he can get you all organized to go to lunch.
All right. Thank you. And to Deidre and Mike and all of you who have served in the armed forces, we thank you. Are we ready for one door prize? All right.
Okay. This time, you guys, we have a double whammy, because if we don't, we're not going to get rid of them all. We have a $25 certificate again from United Blind of Whatcom County, and if you're a guy that gets this, you can do whatever you want. We have a 76-piece Ulta makeup case.
I want it.
You want? Yeah. You want to give it to your wife, don't you? And, it's cash. The $25 is cash. So you can go out and spend it right away. Ron Bradshaw? Yeah. Oh, he's here!
Ron, you'll look marvelous.
Oh, no, I did. Remember that.
All right, it is time for lunch. I'm going to ask you all to do a little church here before, as we break. If we could depart with the back rows first and then work our way forward so that we're not all running over each other and our dogs. So back rows first, lunch is across the hallway, and we will... see you back here at 1:15.